Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest. Not so mad science on Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to tonight's edition, August 28th, 2018. This edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. It is a sad day and a joyous one here in Detroit City today. Today is the opening of the viewing of the majesty and the wonder of our dearly departed queen, the queen of soul, the queen of R&B, the queen of music, Aretha Franklin. She is lying in state today at the Black History Museum, the Charles H. Wright Museum in the downtown area of the city of Detroit. It is open to the public, so I encourage you, one and all, to pay your respects and your homage to the Queen, our departed sister, Aretha Franklin, at the Charles H. Wright Museum. There is evidence of a connection between cannabis use and schizophrenia, but it's unclear whether the drug leads to the disorder of schizophrenia or vice versa. A new study published Monday, which relies partly on genetic data from a company known as 23andMe. For those of you who do not know what 23andMe is, 23andMe is a privately held personal genomics and biotechnology company based in Mountain View, California. The company is named for the 23 pairs of chromosomes in a normal human cell. The executives of this company are Ann Wojcicki, Richard Scheller, Emily Drabrant Conley, Jonathan Ward, and Robert Gentleman. So, we've heard previously from the research done by noted historian, educator, academic, Dr. Wesley Muhammad, that marijuana had been weaponized. What did he mean by that? That the chemically induced and produced marijuana had a primary effect on those with degrees of melanin in their bodies. The effect of this chemically induced and produced marijuana caused a heightened degree of effeminity amongst young black males and aggression in black females. But his research, though consummated and validated has been attacked and largely ignored by the overall population of the country. Ignoring the truth of it suited well better those in positions of power and authority to maintain the homosexuality induced in black males and the heightened aggression in black females. But there is also another effect. We have known for decades, millennia, if you will, that marijuana once smoked made you paranoid. So, what does it mean to be paranoid? Well, paranoid, by the definition, is characterized by one who is suffering from a mental condition of paranoia. Okay, so what is paranoia? Well, paranoia is defined as a mental condition characterized by delusions of persecution, unwarranted jealousy, or exaggerated self-importance, typically elaborated into an organized system. It may be and can be an aspect of a chronic personality disorder or of drug abuse or of a serious condition such as schizophrenia, in which the person loses touch with reality. So we can say that paranoia is the lesser status of schizophrenia, where schizophrenia is a complete break in one's ability to comprehend their environment. But you don't have to listen to my definition. The National Institute of Medical, NIMH, defines schizophrenia as a chronic and severe mental disorder, and that is the National Institute of Mental Health, defines schizophrenia, once again, as a chronic and severe mental disorder that affects how a person thinks, feels, and behaves. People with schizophrenia may seem like they have lost touch with reality, although schizophrenia is not as common as other mental disorders. The symptoms are very, very, very disabling. So, what have we learned now recently? That there is evidence of a connection between cannabis and its usage with schizophrenia. There was a new study published this past Monday, which relies partly on the genetic data from 23andMe volunteers that might offer a little clarity on that link. It found that people genetically at risk of schizophrenia are more likely to start smoking marijuana, suggesting the disorder itself might cause cannabis use in some people. The current study, published in Nature and Neuroscience, is a continuation of previous efforts to sketch out the genetic variations that make people more likely to start using cannabis, also known as marijuana, in a project known as the International Cannabis Consortium. The study office, which includes some researchers from DNA test company 23andMe, studied the anonymized, meaning anonymous, the anonymized genetic data taken from previous or ongoing studies, such as the one done in the UK by Biobank, as well as from people who have permitted their DNA to be used for research, such as those who signed up for the genetic testing from 23andMe. Overall, they've looked at more than 180,000 people, making this the largest study of its kind, according to the authors. A person's genetic code can differ slightly from someone else's in a lot of ways, but the most common variation is called a single nucleotide polymorphism, or NSP. A NSP is a minute change in the building blocks that make up DNA and RNA, known as nucleotides. So in one specific section of DNA, for example, most people have what is called an adenine, A-D-E-N-I-N-E, one of the four nucleobases that make up a nucleotide. But the others might have a cytosine, C-Y-T-O-S-I-N-E, a C instead. Using different tests, they also found 35 genes in 16 different sections across the genome that were associated with cannabis use. Many of these genes seem to be associated with other habits, personality, mental health conditions, particularly the gene called CADM2. Variations in the CADM2, the authors noted, have already been linked to taking more risk, greater alcohol use, and personality traits such as extroversion. They also found a genetic overlap with schizophrenia. Now, I'm going to footnote this. It has been known for well over 100 years in the medical community that there are those who have a genetic propensity to alcohol abuse. In the streets, you say, hey, you can't handle your alcohol. This person's an alcoholic because, well, they have a genetic propensity to suffer from alcoholism. Thus, we have found evidence proving out that the over usage of marijuana is beginning to show evidence of schizophrenia. And those who also have a propensity for alcoholism have an increased risk of schizophrenia. That is not a big surprise, because previous studies have often shown that cannabis or marijuana usage and schizophrenia are associated with each other. The lead author of the work, Jacqueline Vink, a researcher at Radboud University in the Netherlands said in a statement, and I quote, however, we also study whether this association is casual. What does that mean? Let's put it this way. Casual smoking, recreational smoking will produce the same result of schizophrenia. They attempted to find a possible cause and effect relationship using a method called the Mendelian randomization. This technique lets geneticists ask whether having the known gene for one thing, being schizophrenia in this study, directly predisposes you to another thing, being marijuana. In this case, they found evidence that being genetically vulnerable to schizophrenia made some people more likely to use pot, possibly as a way to cope with their condition, according to the authors. This finding, in particular, is important because we still don't really understand how cannabis and schizophrenia are tied to one another. Other research has found that pot use itself raises the inherent risk of schizophrenia, especially if begun at an early or young age by people already at risk of mental illness. Let us stop right there. The median age of marijuana usage in the black community can be found to be as young as 6 to 7 years of age. Now, quite frankly, as a parent, if I found my 6 or 7 year old smoking pot, I'd break their friggin' kneecaps. And as a parent, if I knew that my children were smoking my weed, my anger would not be because I caught them smoking my weed, get your own, but I need my behind broke into several thousand pieces, never to be glued back together again. Because Humpty Dumpty didn't need to fall off the wall. That Humpty Dumpty need to be thrown off the wall, never to be seen again, for allowing their child to partake in such a devilish act. The authors are careful to point out their single study doesn't disprove that theory, but it does suggest, as other genetic studies have, the relationship is complicated. The researchers next plan to study if there are specific genes that can predict more frequent or heavier usage of marijuana. I want you all to think about this before you start telling people, well, I have a prescription for the marijuana, and you smoke it in the house in your room, close the door, thinking your children are not affected by it. Or you engage in the usage of marijuana with your children. Or your son or daughter is the local establishment that provides the marijuana. And if you think because you got a prescription and you go to the local head shop along 7 Mile or some other community, you notice you don't see these places in the outer suburbs in the surrounding area around the city of Detroit, but you do see them all over our community. They're sprouting up like liquor stores have. On every other corner, there's a liquor store. So the drug of choice is still predominantly alcohol, but marijuana usage is soon to take that over. Quite frankly, one goes with the other. but postulate in the density of the thickness of your brains and ask the question, why? Why is there so much mental illness in your community now? The opioid crisis. Oh boy, it has outdone crack in those communities where opioids are financially accessible. It is within the Congress and the Senate where there has been great debate as to why the crack epidemic was not attacked with the veracity that the opioid epidemic in those communities has been attacked for a cure and not incarceration. Where marijuana usage is now legalized and a controlled substance which can be gained through a prescription, which you might as well just say you walk to the local candy store, because a prescription for marijuana is a dime a dozen. Some doctors, that's all they prescribe. You go in there with $25 and you walk out with a prescription for $300 worth of marijuana. And the government pays for it. Ensuring that your schizophrenia reaches an apex. Once again, schizophrenia is a dissociative condition that fractures your concept of reality. It is a chronic and a severe mental disorder that affects how you think, how you feel, how you behave. You become a danger to yourself, ultimately becoming a danger to others. Your schizophrenia will get you killed if you're in a car and you're pulled over by the police. You're suffering from a mental condition brought on by your usage of marijuana. You think because you hide it inside a cigar? Yeah, you increased its potency and you increased its effect of causing schizophrenia as well, as other diseases are increased. Once again, this is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. For those of you who have to run, we will be right back. So, hit that train whistle. And we're going to come on that train approach.
I realize that you've been hurt deeply, because I've been there. But regardless to who, what, why, when, and where, we're all precious in His sight. And a rose is still and always will. arose.
Welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. There has been great debate in the science world with regards to what is a subject known as Egyptology. One must ask themselves, why is there a science dedicated to one particular class of people? There is no Romanology for the study of Rome. There is no Englishology or Europeology for the study of the people of Europe. But there is a science dedicated specifically to the people of Egypt. Now, the mistake that is made when we think of the people of Egypt, we think of the people of Egypt as being Arab, a fair-skinned people. The truth of the matter is, the people of Egypt, or Kemet, are a darker people. Before the advent of the Roman conqueror coming through, therefore, Egyptology and the study of Egyptology as a science predates the advent of the Roman Empire and its conquering of Egypt and installing its people as the pharaoh. So that makes this next discussion with regards to ancient Egypt very, very profound, because it has been discussed that ancient Egyptians had been making mummies longer than anyone thought. Kiana Smith penned an article for Ars Technica, a science.com journal, periodical, that comes out regularly on the net and is available in hard copy at a lot of newsstands. It was on August 16th of this year that she penned an article that discusses the subject matter. Ancient Egyptians started embalming their dead about 1,500 years earlier than archaeologists previously realized, according to the chemical analysis of the funerary or the funeral wrappings of a young man who died in Upper Egypt around 3600 BCE. University of York archaeologist Stephen Buckley and his colleagues identified embalming compounds in organic residues from the mummy's linen wrappings. They also examined the microscopic structures of the wrappings fibers and radiocarbon dated the mummy to be between 3,700 and 3,500 BCE. That's about 500 years before Egypt was believed to have been a unified country. This process now suggests that the, and I don't want to use the phrase city-state, but the country-state of Egypt was far more unified and pragmatic and industrious 500 to 1500 years sooner than today's modern science had originally calculated. It took until 3100 BCE for an upper or a southern Egyptian ruler named Namar to conquer what is believed to have been Lower Northern Egypt, merging the two into a single kingdom. Egyptian embalming is thought to have gotten its start in what is believed to have been, according to today's theology, a pre-dynastic period, or even earlier, when people noticed that the arid heat of the sand tended to dry and preserve bodies buried in the desert. Eventually, the idea of preserving the body after death worked its way into the Egyptian religious belief system. When people began to bury the dead in rock tombs away from the desiccating sand, they used chemicals like natron salt and plant-based resins for the embalming. Archaeologists had previously assumed that the Turin mummy was the product of natural desiccation. But it turns out his body had been treated with antibacterial compounds before burial, and the recipe is remarkably similar to the ones used by the embalmers thousands of years earlier in the unified Egypt of the pharaohs. Very little, and I quote, very little was known about the mummy previously, and this was the first interdisciplinary scientific study to investigate. Dr. Buckley told Ars Technica, the mummy had been part of the collection at the Egyptian Museum in Turin, Italy. Now that concerns me individually. The Egyptian Museum is in Turin, Italy. Why isn't it in Egypt? Why isn't the mummy being studied where it came from? Could it be that archaeologists are nothing but grave robbers who steal the remains of the buried and take it back to their land where they're from to study how people indigenous to the land they stole the mummy from tended to their dead, looking for insights into their own longevity? One must consider these things. Since the museum director is supposedly said to have purchased the mummy from an Egyptian dealer in 1901, and modern archaeologists aren't even sure exactly where the mummy was originally buried, Dr. Buckley says the original grave probably lay somewhere near modern-day Thebes, known as Luxor, or a site called Djebelin, about 25 miles to the south. These prehistoric bodies were wrapped in linen and rush matting, surrounded by grave goods such as the personal items and bowls of food, and buried simply in pits dug out of the sand. Macquarie University Egyptologist Jana Jones, the lead author of the newspaper, told Ars Technica, some of those grave good news now reside at the museum with their late or former owners. These things are studyable. Previous researchers had suggested that the mummy hailed from the earlier pre-dynastic period, but a combination of radiocarbon dating and detective work helped Dr. Buckley and his colleagues narrow it down further. microscopic examination of the mummy's wrappings reveal the spin direction of the fibers in the textile. The result meant that the mummy could not date later than 3500 BC because the textile technology changed after this date. So despite the radiocarbon dates of 3650 to 3380 BC for the mummy, we could narrow that date now to 3650, 3500 BC by using all the science available, Dr. Buckley told this to our technicians. A visual examination of the wear patterns on his teeth also indicated that the dead man was between 20 and 30 years old when he died. Previous studies had suggested an age closer to 40. We cannot be sure of the social status of the mummy, although he does seem to have been in reasonable health, apart what appears to be a healed skull fracture, which he survived. Future research may provide new information, forensically, of course, but so far, this is as much as they can say about the mummy. Buckley and his colleagues analyzed organic residues from the mummy's wrappings with a technique called gas chromatography mass spectrometry, in which vaporized chemical compounds are sorted by their mass so scientists can analyze the chemical composition of a sample. The GCMS, or the gas chromatography mass spectrometry, is able to separate the constituents of the complex mixtures and provide a chemical fingerprint for each of those constituents, allowing us to then identify each constituent. And from that determine, which is not always possible, the natural products constituting the organic extract, i.e. the embalming agent applied to the mummy. Museum mummies, I'm going to say, sometimes get treated with a barrage of pesticides and chemical preservatives, including drying oils like linseed, tree resins, and cellulose-based treatments. But because the Turin mummy hadn't received any treatments, he has just been stored in a special case to protect against moisture and microbes. Buckley and his colleagues wouldn't have to account for those modern contaminants in their study. They found that the wrappings were saturated with a mixture of plant oil and aromatic plant extract, a gum or sugar, and heated conifer resin. Interestingly, though, conifers aren't native to Egypt, so that material would have had to be imported, most likely from the nearest source in what would be considered modern-day Israel. So this hints at the pre-dynastic Egyptian trade network. But the scientific thing is that those ingredients were essentially the same one used to treat the bodies of the new kingdom royalty 2,500 years later. These compounds helped ensure that decay-causing bacteria couldn't recolonize the body once it had dried out. Of course, those antibacterial embalming agents were just one step and what had and what they had by the new kingdom becoming a very complex 70-day embalming process, with the practical work of embalming interwoven with ritual. The pharaohs would have had their organs removed and placed in special containers called canopic jars. For instance, and the body would have been dried with natron salt before being wrapped and treated with embalming compounds like the one on the Turin mummy. The Turin mummy seems to have kept all his organs, and it's not likely he was treated with natron salt. But he was buried in hot, dry desert sand, which would have kept his body desiccated. Now, I know that there is somebody out there in the listening audience who wants to know, Brother Harold, forgive my mental instability, my vertical mental instability. What the hell does desiccated mean? Well, I'm going to tell you. Desiccated is spelled D-E-S. I-C-C. Not D-E-S-S. But D-E-S-I-C-C-A-T-E-D. Desiccated, by definition, means this. Desiccate means to remove the moisture from something, particularly food or other organic material, in order to preserve it. So it is essentially the removal of moisture when something dries out. That's what desiccated means. Okay? They dried them out. Sucked all the fluid out the body, and that's what you got. So, during the pharaonic period, or the period time of the pharaohs, the bodies of the elite were buried in tombs, and so no longer in direct contact with the hot, dry sand. As a result of this, bodies would have decomposed quite rapidly had they not removed the internal organs and used a drying agent to remove water from the body. Hence, a more elaborate procedure was needed compared to the burials of the prehistoric, or what is thought to be the pre-dynastic period. The findings is believed to, and I say is believed, not exactly or factually, but it is believed to support an earlier study by Dr. Buckley and his colleagues, in which they found evidence of very, very similar embalming compounds on fragments of linen wrappings that had come from a pre-dynastic burial in Mostaganem, about 232 miles north of the Turin mummy's long-lost grave. Some of those wrappings dated to as early as 4300 BCE, about 600 years older than the Turin mummy. And others dated to as late as 3100 BCE. But none of them were still associated with an actual mummy. And I'm going to stop right there for a quick moment, because I can hear the question coming, even though I don't hear anybody calling in to ask it. They want to know.
brother.
What does BCE mean? BCE means before the Common Era. And BC means before Christ. They mean the same thing previous to year 1 CE, or the Common Era. This is the same as the year AD, or Anno Domini. The latter means in the years of the Lord, often translated in the years of our Lord. So BCE and BC essentially mean the same thing, though they're termed differently. Before the Common Era, or before Christ. Before Christ in this case would be 2,000 years ago. So anything before Christ would be added in terms of 3,500 years before Christ, or 3,600 years before Christ. So it's roughly 5,000 to 6,000 years before the birth of the man called Christ. And I say that quite deliberately, the man called Christ. That is not to imply that he is, or say that he is the Christ. Some believe he is, some believe he isn't. So, to satisfy all, the man called Christ. So, we got a common understanding of BCE and BC. When the Mostaganem burials were evacuated, excavated. In the 1920s, archaeologists often, and just call them grave robbers, because they weren't necessarily archaeologists given permission by the country in which they were digging to take bodies anywhere. They stole them. They were conquerors, digging up the dead to find the history of the indigenous people that were there. Why they were doing it is a subject we'll discuss on another program. Only to say that these grave robbers, under the title or the tutelage of a term called archaeologists, often considered the human remains themselves unimportant. So the mummies remained in Egypt while the textiles were sent to England for study. The current study is the first one to identify what is believed to be pre-dynastic embalming materials in an intact mummy. Though the mummy is not the earliest burial to reveal the formative embalming agents dating back to 4,300 years before the Common Era or before Christ. It is the first intact surviving individual to reveal what would become a key part of the iconic process that would later become pharaonic Egyptian mummification. And I encourage you all to get it wrapped around this material you call your gray matter and dump the nonsense and take in the serious data. Egyptian does not mean Arab. The Egyptians of the pre-dynastic and pharaonic periods prior to the incursion of the Roman Empire's conquering armies coming through were people of deep dark color. Tar babies. And the presence of the same embalming recipe at burials hundreds of miles apart during Egypt's pre-dynastic phase could tell archaeologists things about the development of an ancient Egyptian culture. When Namir united the two kingdoms around 3100 BC, before Christ existed, or before Christ, Upper and Lower Egypt had similar but distinct languages, cultures, and belief systems. That's why, for instance, some of the ancient Egyptians' pantheons, as we know it, seems to have so many deities with overlapping roles or seemingly conflicting backstories. But these finds may suggest a commonality. It was the difference of coming from one neighborhood in L.A. to a neighborhood in New York. Same terminology, different applications. But you do understand each other based on its inflection and usage to know what they mean. Nah, I mean, know what I'm saying? What's up? But I'm gonna kick your ass is the same regardless of where you go. It is a universal terminology. They also shift our understanding when ancient Egyptian belief without the afterlife began to take shape. And not without the afterlife, but about the afterlife began to take shape. Without written text, the way people bury their dead offers the best insight into what they believed about life and death. And even then, you're going to misunderstand it. The finding of this in the 2014 study suggests that the concept of an afterlife, with the physical preservation of the body at its heart, was already developing some 1,500 years earlier than previously thought. This is significant. If you but invest some time into understanding. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. So, I'm going to get you with a little bit of Wolfman, but it ain't Jack. Black Rock.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
before we continue, let me first say welcome back. We're going to continue to honor the Queen. And I'm going to send this out to someone.
Do that for me now.
Welcome back. Thrillist Magazine published an article today by Sam Blum. An article reads, a potentially hazardous asteroid will pass Earth tonight, but it's nothing to worry about. Now, you hear the word asteroid, and a flurry of doomsday scenarios come to mind. Couple that with potentially hazardous, and you're absolutely certain that the Earth is in mortal danger. But put down the Xanax, close all the tabs you opened on your computer on doomsday prepper websites. The quote-unquote potentially hazardous asteroid primed to pass by Earth tonight is nothing to worry about. So if there's no immediate need to seek refuge in a bomb shelter somewhere, why is the asteroid hurling by us at 20,000 miles per hour a non-issue? Well, the answer is simple. The asteroid, which is named 2016 NS23, was labeled a near-Earth object, an NEO, by NASA due to its proximity to the Earth. But close proximity is a relative term. When it passes by the Earth tonight at 11:38 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, it will do so from 5 million miles outside of the Earth's orbit. This is according to a report released by space.com. Lindley Johnson, planetary defense officer at NASA headquarters in Washington, told the space publication, and I quote, there is absolutely nothing for concern by this pass of 2016 NS23. This object is merely designated a potentially hazardous asteroid, a PHA, because its orbit over time brings it within 5 million miles or 8 million kilometers of the Earth's orbit. But there is nothing hazardous or even unique about this pass of the asteroid. To put the distance in starker perspective, 2016 NF23 is set to pass by the Earth at 13.2 lunar distances. Now, what does that mean? That's 13.2 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. The asteroid garnered a fair bit of hysteria due to some of its jarring features. It's roughly between 229 feet and 524 feet in diameter, according to NASA, making it potentially larger than the Great Pyramid of Giza. Whoop-de-doo. There are, at this very moment, much larger wayward rocks traveling through space that pose an incredibly tiny chance of killing you. More to the point, near-Earth objects regularly traverse the Earth's orbit or the outer reaches of the Earth's orbit and often do it as closer distances than the 2016 NF23. Per space.com, and I quote again, as of August 23rd, NASA was aware of 1,912 potentially hazardous asteroids. Does that give you 1,912 reasons to fear the impending destruction of our planet? Oh, stop being such a silly wuss and do a little bit of homework. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. La 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 la. we mourn the passing of our queen, the queen of soul, our dear sister Aretha Franklin, today we must also celebrate the birth of our sister Katherine Johnson, a mathematician at NASA's Langley Research Center in Virginia, whose participation, whose calculations, along with a group of other sisters, without whose illustrious work there never would have been a space program to put a man on the moon. Today is the 100th birthday of Katherine Johnson. She's celebrating what is called 100 trips around the sun this weekend. Sister Johnson was one of NASA's human computers whose calculations propelled NASA's spacecraft to the stars, turned 100 on August 26. Johnson is a retired NASA Langley mathematician who was one of the single most integral persons to developing human spaceflight in America. As students, we were denied her and others' participation. We were denied their history so that we would never know that without their great work, there would not have been a space program. Johnson, who was played by Taraji P. Henson in the movie Hidden Figures, began her career on NASA as a team of black women who were also referred to as human computers. Like the other women in this group, Sister Johnson broke down the barriers as a black woman despite anti-black prejudice. NASA honored Sister Johnson on her birthday, and this is a reminder to the world of her unparalleled contributions to human spaceflight. One of a number of black women doing incredible work at NASA, never given the public credit for their achievement and the role of the black community in the aeronautical space program. She opened the doors for Julia Williams Byrd, Langley's acting chief technologist, who said in a statement at NASA's Langley facility, the women's computers of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So today, we celebrate and we honor our sister. And the womb that bore her and the father that protected and helped raise that child to become a human computer. Sister Katherine Johnson, we bow our heads to you as we mourn the passing of the Queen, but we raise our fists in united strength and power for the work that you have done and what you mean to us today. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, as we close out tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. For those who have the time and the ability, find your way downtown to the Charles H. Wright Museum of Black History. Pay your honor and your respect to the Queen. Don't just play her music. Go home and share with your families the achievement of Sister Katherine Johnson. This honors the work of the Queen as a trailblazer in the arts as we raise our hands in glory to the science and the mathematics. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Allah willing, I'll speak with you next week.